Hi, good morning. A lot of early birds and adventuresome people who could find the hallway or find this meeting room. Good morning, I'm Catherine McCarter. I'm the Executive Director of the Ecological Society of America, and it's my privilege to welcome you here today to the 95th Annual Meeting of ESA and to the City of Pittsburgh. Before I formally announce and tell you a little bit about the session this morning, I've been asked to make a couple of special announcements. We're meeting this week in the world's largest gold LEED certified convention center. And during our meeting, the convention center has asked us if we would participate in an effort they're doing to conduct an audit of their effectiveness of their green practices and design. So together with Carnegie Mellon and others, the convention center will be, you may see them in some of the sessions doing some air quality testing or some equipment efficiency testing, and you may be asked to participate in a survey. And so we do encourage you to help them as they do a sort of a check of their green initiatives. I also want to mention something that's very exciting to us at ESA and point you toward a session on Tuesday. ESA, for the first time in 7 years, is launching a new journal. Ecosphere is going to be an online-only, totally open-access journal with a dedication to rapid publication and a very rigorous peer review. We're launching it at this meeting. We're very, very excited about it. And those of you who are interested in learning more about Ecosphere, we urge you to attend a brown bag lunch session, which will occur in room 305 tomorrow, Tuesday. And you can learn all more about our plans for Ecosphere. And now to look at the program this morning. The theme of the meeting, as you know, is both timely and extremely important. Global warming, the legacy of our past, the challenge for our future. This topic addresses what many feel is probably the most serious environmental threat that faces the biosphere. We have an excellent program planned for you all week that will begin to address some of these issues and many others. And we really hope that you will take full advantage of all of the scientific offerings, the business meetings, the exhibits, the poster sessions, the receptions, and the wonderful opportunities to network with your colleagues. The program this morning will include a chance to meet our program chair and local host who have worked the theme through this meeting and have planned all of it for you. We will also hear our president, Mary Power, discuss how big is a community. We will honor those winning ESA's most prestigious awards, and we will hear an address, and we will be challenged, I suspect, by Steve Running, who will ask if ecologists will become the global carbon cops of the future. But before I turn the podium over to Mary Power, who is going to be presiding over this session, it's my pleasure to tell you a little bit about Mary and her accomplishments, and that is a pleasure. Mary Power is a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of California, Berkeley. She received her BA in biology from Brown University and her MS in biology from Boston University Marine Program at Woods Hole. Her PhD is from the University of Washington in zoology. Her research focus is on food web interactions and ecosystem fluxes along river drainage networks. In addition to guiding ESA as our president and as our executive board chair, Mary Power is past president of the American Society of Naturalists and currently serves on the Board of Trustees for the California Nature Conservancy. She is the founding director of the California Biodiversity Center, which is an organizational research unit that focuses on collaborations between the Berkeley Natural History Museums and its natural history field stations. Mary has also served on the NOAA Fisheries Salmon Recovery Science Advisory Panel, that's a mouthful, and the executive committee of the National Center for Earth Systems Dynamics. She is a fellow in the California Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Her awards and honors include the Hutchinson Award from the American Society of Limnology and Oceanography and the Kemp Award for Distinguished Ecologists from the University of Umeå and the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Mary, I can tell you, has been one of the most delightful and energetic and enthusiastic presidents that I've had the pleasure to work with. Together with President-elect Terry Chapin, they are creating a vision for planetary stewardship that is guiding an agenda for ESA and is inspiring our members to action. Like a true scientist, I've noticed that Mary is absolutely excited by anything she doesn't know, and she works wholeheartedly to understand everything that she does not yet currently know about, which isn't much, I suspect, but she will find out about it, and she will know. Her ability to encompass and integrate new ideas and knowledge is really awesome. But the feature I would say the most about Mary is she is a warm and caring person, and she's someone that any of us would be honored to call a friend. It's been wonderful working with Mary Power. Please join me in thanking Mary Power for her service as president of Ecological Society and her dedication to ESA. Mary?
Introduction. Thank you. I had such a wonderful experience working with this group, and everybody is passionate and committed and visionary in very different ways in the ESA leadership, and we certainly wouldn't work effectively without the amazing leadership of our executive director, Catherine. She's held the organization together, and those of you who've served in administration and in leadership at ESA know how much we owe to her for making our society effective and coherent, despite the diverse, exciting, and sometimes overly cosmic ambitions that ecologists have. So thank you, Catherine. It's been a wonderful, wonderful couple of years, and I have one more as past president. I, by the way, encourage any of you who are approached to serve in any form on the governing board to not run away. It's a commitment, but it's worth it. Now I'm to greet the audience, and Catherine will take back all the nice things she said if I don't tell you about the Fund for the Future. There are flyers on all the seats, and of course our students are our future in the Ecological Society of America. And we're looking for donations of various types. Those of you who could only give a little, your gift is still very important to stabilizing our programs like the SEEDS Network, the Strategy for Ecology Education for Diversity and Sustainability, and for graduate student travel and support, and other programs. So consider giving, and I can tell you that the money will be very well used. I've been so impressed with ESA's dynamic, energetic, well-organized, and visionary graduate students. They're hitting the ground running, and with your support and other support, they can make a big difference in the world. They already are. Now, I'm to introduce a person who took on a huge task, Frank Gillum. And he is our program chair, came up with the very, very appropriate theme of global warming, legacy of our past, challenge for our future. And Frank, if you can come up here, we have an appreciative gift for you. And then Frank, in turn, will introduce our local program host.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. First of all, I thought that the bottle of single malt scotch in my room was my thank you gift. So now I have something to drink it out of. I think that's pretty good right there. That's really impressive. First, I wanted to spend my few moments basically acknowledging and thanking people because this would not have come about if it hadn't been for the efforts of many people. I want to first recognize and introduce my partner in crime, Steve Tonser, the local host chair. Could you please stand and be recognized? Yes. He had the very difficult task of putting together all these wonderful field trips and dividing his time at in D.C. at NSF. So thank you very much for your excellent effort. I would actually like to start out with a bit of a personal note. I've been both blessed and cursed with an excellent memory, and I recall 1982, Penn State University. I was a struggling PhD student working with Norm Christensen, and that was my very first ESA meeting, and I remember how much I got out of that even as a graduate student. And those of you who are grad students, just think, one of these days you might be up here. But this is the first time I've ever had a chance to address the entire society. And I would just like to thank the society for all of these years of great meetings. It's meant a lot to my career, and I really appreciate that. And so mostly I would like to thank the society for giving me the opportunity to serve as program chair, to give back a little bit of what the society has given to me. So I really thank you for that. In particular, however, I want to acknowledge the exceptional staff at ESA. I want you to know that we are in great hands, all the way from Catherine all the way down. I shouldn't say down, maybe across. How about that? And in particular, Michelle Horton has been instrumental in putting all of this together. Is Alita Wiley here anywhere? She was the program coordinator, and she kind of got the ball rolling, and then she moved on to other employment, and Jennifer Ream took over. And I wanted to say I'm very much impressed with how seamless the transition was. When I first got the email that Alita was going to be leaving, I almost quit. I thought, oh my word, what are we going to do? And Jennifer has been phenomenal. As I shared with the Board of Governors yesterday, the best analogy would not be coming off the bench. The best analogy would be going on to the interstate without an on-ramp. At 70 miles an hour, and that's pretty much what Jennifer did, and I wanted to thank her for that. Where is she? Is she anywhere here? Well, crap. Okay. So, anyway, if you see Jennifer, Michelle, any of the staff, thank them for putting together this this meeting. So, thank you so much. Is that it? Okay. Thank you.
Is Michelle Horton here? Is Michelle here? Oh, there she is back there. So please give an applause to Michelle Horton, our program organizer. Thank you, Michelle. So I guess I get to address you briefly now. And my address, I decided to just kind of pose the question that is foremost in my mind about community, community in many, many senses. So first I want to just go through some of the ideas, the very interesting, I think beautiful ideas in some cases, that ecologists have had about what is an ecological community or what is an ecosystem if you fold in the physical-chemical processes. But then I want to think about the more current thinking where many of our leaders in this society are pushing us to incorporate human behavior and humans into these ecological systems. So how big is an ecological social system, social ecological system, in the sense that the Resilience Alliance are discussing? And then let's focus on our own community, the community of the Ecological Society of America. And the question is, we have a diverse, fairly large, moderately large, 10,000-ish community. Are we big enough to do this job that Frank poses, dealing with the challenge for our future of turning the planet around? So this is a definition I like very much that Rob Caldwell came up with. That I like it because it has two parts. The biotic context of a population, it's an annual review, he's reviewing populations, but he's saying their context is the community, an association of coexisting populations bounded functionally by the domain of their interactions or spatially by their co-occurrence in a habitat or biotope. So the first definition, the process definition, is attractive. And Rob is obviously thinking of the processes and the interactions that make give a community somehow some coherence so that they could be at least partially bounded. And I think as ecologists, even though this is a British ecologist, not an American ecologist, but ESA and ecologists in general could be proud that Tansley was so quick off the mark. Catherine. So quick off the mark, to apply general systems science, which was just developed in the late 20s by von Bertalanffy, to ecology. So already, ecologists, British ecologists, were discussing ecosystems. And in 1935, Tansley published this incredible paper, The Use and Abuse of Vegetational Concepts. I think people were classifying plant associations at that time, and he pointed out, look, vegetation changes. Let's study the change and not the static pattern so that we can understand plants and the roles they play in the world. So there's something about a community like this riparian forest or the grass, the grazed grassland beyond it, that some features remain recognizable even though individuals, populations are blinking in and out. Despite change, there's some continuity. And as Tansley considered this further, he realized, with a very open-minded but optimistic statement, these ecosystems, as we may call them, are of the most various kinds and sizes, ranging from atoms to the universe. That's pretty open-minded. The systems we isolate mentally for study are not only included as part of larger ones, but they also overlap, interlock, and interact with each other. The isolation is partly artificial. See, he's recognizing there's some reality, but also it's arbitrary. You can study systems with various boundaries that you choose, but you might make better choices in some cases than others. The isolation is partly artificial, but by isolating these systems, it's the only way we can proceed. And if you're curious about these pictures, let's see if I can put. Oh, I'm getting the. I can't seem to get the pointer to. There we go. That's epiphytes on a macroalga called Cladophora. This would be the scale of tens of microns. Here's that macroalga making a network that attaches to stream beds. It's the fuel for a food web network in the stream, and Cladophora interactions with weather, hydrology, land use determine how much of this stuff evolves, and then that might actually have some biogeochemical effects on the ocean as the products of the river drain out and fertilize our nearshore waters. So it's a very interesting, to me, example of what Tansley's saying. And so here's a diagram that we see very often these days as we ecologists worry about the future and what role we can play in guiding it. So Martin Scheffer et al. Published this paper in which they talked about how systems change as you change at a condition in which they're embedded. An ecosystem state might change gradually. More often likely, it'll change slowly and then pass a threshold and accelerate its change. And here's the system change that is on everybody's mind, that the systems are somewhat stabilized over a large range of conditions, but there's some threshold at which they no longer can hold the integrity to maintain that system, and they flip over to this system. So this is a model that's very much on all of our minds. And what Tansley says about it is, systems show some degree of organization, the inevitable consequences of interactions, and consequent mutual adjustment of components. There is, in fact, this is such an interesting sentence to me, there is a kind of natural selection of incipient systems, and those which can attain the most stable equilibrium survive the longest. They might be the ones we're most likely to recognize as systems in the world. So this is defining a system, that stability. Or now we call it resilience. And the resilience of a system has been much explored and much promoted as a way to think about what we need to do with planetary stewardship, among other things, by people in the Resilience Alliance, including Lance Gunderson, who in 2000 had this definition, that the resilience measures how much disturbance the system absorbs before it changes its structure, its fundamental behavior. And clearly our systems are getting buffeted around by events like the BP oil catastrophe, mega droughts, mega floods, weather extremes are more conspicuous than ever. And a review now tells us that if we have a boundary at which a systems will flip, like the global system of the biosphere, that we may have already transgressed three of those with respect to nitrogen cycling, climate, and biodiversity loss. Rockstrom's et al. Influential review in Nature. So we are in a precarious place with the planet. And is our ESA community big enough to make a difference here? I think we all feel the answer is partly yes. We're certainly not big enough to solve the problem by ourselves. But consider what we have going for us. And as I reflect on ESA membership, I think about us starting with people who loved organisms and natural history, and then thought about population dynamics and species interactions. And this is kind of the historical core in which I my own field, my own interests are centered here. But we have embraced and successfully interacted with biogeochemists and global change scientists. Many of those are not ESA members, but they're close partners. And then we do, as you noticed if you went to Albuquerque, have a very dynamic group in which these global change scientists and biogeochemists who need to understand mechanisms that are mediated often by organisms have good communication with this group and these individuals who need to know what the world's going to throw at their local populations have great insight. And we'll get some of that from Steve Running's plenary talk as he talks to us about whether we should police carbon in the future. Now, this group is epitomized, this close communication is epitomized by Steve Schneider and Terry Root. And I wanted here to pay tribute to Steve. We tragically lost him about a week ago. And although I don't think he was an ESA member, he interacted extremely closely with ecologists and mentored many of them and taught a whole generation how to think brilliantly about the science of climate change and to communicate it passionately but clearly and honestly to the public. So he's a terrible loss, but he's also a wonderful inspiration. And I want just to talk about, as an illustration of this interaction in ASA between organism, population, community ecologists, and global change scientists, their partnership and marriage of ideas as well as in life. Terry knew enough about birds to be able to predict how the northern boundary of their distributions would change if winters got harsher. That takes a lot of insight. She was successful at doing that. And Steve loved birds. He's a bird watcher, and they shared many happy times, including one fairly recently with Paul Ehrlich, who will celebrate Steve also, bird watching in Australia just a month ago. So that is a powerful reminder to us of how important and how close the interactions across those two spheres of interests are in our society. And I want to also celebrate another sphere that I see growing in our society. Ecology has been a very, and it still is, a very academic organization, but more and more we're attracting people here who are closely tied to special places. In some cases, with native Californians here, Karuk people dip fishing for salmon. These people go back many, many generations in a place. They understand it very well. They draw their livelihoods and sometimes their spiritual identities from it. And of course, there are ranchers and fishermen and others that are just also very heavily invested in place. ESA is now incorporating into our group traditional ecological knowledge, local knowledge, and if these are members, we can interact with them. If they're partners, we can figure out how to perhaps learn from them and give them the benefit of some of our approaches and to problems and to forecasting what is going to affect their watersheds or their ranches or their farms. So if you think about our community, how big is our community? Is it big enough to address these problems? Well, no, of course it's not. So we also are partnering with people in other fields. We're partnering with state and federal and international agencies. Often we're funded by them, hopefully. We have a debt to pay if we take tax dollars to citizens and stakeholders, the public, and we also can learn from them. And we are interacting with business corporations. And sometimes the interactions are not always in the direction that we would like. And so let's think now about how we deal with shocks or with these seemingly inexorable changes in Earth's life support system. This is a familiar but I think very good quote from Paul Hawken. If you look at the science of what is happening on Earth, and our pessimistic view don't understand the data, but if you meet the people who are working to restore this Earth and the lives of the poor, you aren't, and you aren't optimistic, you haven't got a pulse. And Ed Johnson, who edits our ecological bulletin, gave me a remarkable book, which I'm going to use to explore this, how big is a community that includes people. Because Tony Jute, talking here about ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey where wealth accumulates and men decay. He's talking about largely income inequity, the inequity of the distribution of wealth here. But he phrases a mind-blowing question. How big is a social ecological system? Well, what is it that defines the workable scope of a community of trust? Because if you think of all the dimensions that have to make our society and the partner societies work together, trust is what we need to work together effectively, to share knowledge, to assume that the taxes that are paid to fund our research are going to produce something useful for society. I just want to outline some opportunities that I think ESA is pushing for ecologists to earn and maintain society's trust. We all have to work at this. Everybody needs to contribute in their own way, but we need to be there when changes or crises happen. We need to have eyes on the ground. I'll tell you that when the BP oil disaster happened, within 48 hours, there were 5 ESA members assembled for a rapid response team. Nadine Lim marshaled them. They were on board within 48 hours. That's pretty good. They are ecologists that work in the affected states, including Robert Twilley on the western margin of the disaster, and Felicia Coleman at the Florida State University Coastal Marine Lab on the eastern margin of that disaster. So we're there. We have eyes on the ground. And I would just put in a word here that we need to consider the maintenance and support of small distributed field stations, because it's not clear that the large national centers are going to be in the right place at the right time with the right expertise to handle all of the surprises that we're going to see coming. So small distributed field stations, great people usually working on a shoestring. We need to keep those places supported. Okay, be useful. Obviously, we need to get better at communicating the science of understanding first, and then communicating what we're understanding about ecological change. There's going to be a lot on that at this meeting. The communication includes trying to reach the public in an optimistic way, and Paul Ehrlich and Hyle Mooney are going to introduce the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, trying to understand human psychology. Our communication programs that teach are wonderful. You know about SEEDS, No Child's Left Indoors, EcoEd Digital Library. Get to know these. And if you have things that can communicate to and excite young people, these are great outlets. And then the defensible data. We need to, if we're going to serve and earn society's trust and the tax dollars with which they fund us, we need to have defensible data, and we need to share those in a timely fashion. The student section chair, Rob Salguero Gomez, managed to round up, at this point, several dozen ecologists who are ready to share data on the Gulf states of ecosystem processes like biogeochemistry in the Apalachicola River before the disaster happened. So he's collected metadata and has those people organized to share that data as they become useful. There's going to be a policy for making us share our published data in a raw form that's spearheaded by the American Society of Naturalists, but the Ecological Society is certainly discussing it, and so is NSF. So these are the things we can do. And I just want to talk then about Terry Chapin's connection to environmental psychology. One message is that as we face these challenges, fear and guilt narrow the mind. Curiosity, awe, sense of connecting, nurturing opens the mind. Another plug for this symposium on Wednesday morning, the Millennium Assessment of Human Behavior, and then an introduction to our forthcoming presidents, Terry Chapin, who really got us all three of us on board with planetary stewardship as a theme for 3 years so we could have more time to work on it. And the new president-elect, Steward Pickett, his parents often obviously predestined him for this mission when they named him and even spelled it correctly, that it's going to be stewardship in 3 years. So with that, I'll thank you. And I think now I get to participate in the introduction of the past presidents and the presidents-elect, which you've already seen. But if Terry and Stuart are here, could you, is Terry Chapin here? Yes, there's Terry. So I guess we can. And is Stuart Pickett here? So, and now the past presidents, if the past presidents would like to stand and be recognized, that would be great. Cy Levin, Alan Kovich, Jeff Schlesinger, and now for the awards ceremony. And Deborah Goldberg, there she is. Deborah Goldberg will present the award winners, and Lily Schwartz on the ESA staff will accompany her.
Okay. Multiple computers here. Welcome, everybody. Before presenting the awards, what I would like to express thanks on behalf of ESA to all the people who work so hard on the awards committees. I'll give you the names of the committee chairs at the end, but their hard work and good judgment is what made these awards possible, and I simply get to help present them, but they did all the work. The first award is the Buell Award. I've got two computers here and I'm going to make a mistake. Okay. Is the Buell Award winner here? Okay, good. So, wait, come on up. You're going to have to come up. I'll be describing the awards and then we'll present them. So Murray Buell ascribed great importance to the participation of students at meetings and to excellence in the presentation of papers. To honor his dedication to the Ecological Society of America and to the younger generation of ecologists, this award is presented to a student for the outstanding oral presentation at the Society's meetings, annual meeting. So the winner this year is Divya Uma for her paper, Chemical Mediation of Prey Recognition by Spider Hunting Wasps. The work, oh, there's more. Wait, it's not this fast. The presentation described work examining two alternative hypotheses about the factors that determine susceptibility of spiders to predation by wasps. The standard hypothesis that she was looking at is that web architecture determines susceptibility, that is, three-dimensional webs are less susceptible than spiders with two-dimensional webs. But she also tested the hypothesis that it's not web architecture at all, but a chemical cue on the cuticles. Using what one judge referred to as a fantastic series of experiments, she discriminated between these hypotheses and showed clearly that it was not web architecture at all, but cuticular chemistry that provided the key cues for these wasps to find appropriate prey. She gave an exceptionally clear presentation, answered questions thoroughly and knowledgeably. In fact, she received the highest possible scores on every category from all the judges. And that's a rare thing to happen in the history of this award. So please join me in congratulating Divya as the recipient of the 2010 Buell Award. Okay, the next award is the Lucy Brown Award for Best Student Poster Presentation. Lucy Brown was an eminent plant ecologist and the first woman president of the Ecological Society of America. Besides describing and mapping the deciduous forest regions of eastern North America, what she is probably most well known for, she was a dedicated teacher and role model for her students. This award, this year's Lucy Brown Award, is going to Janice Bauman. Janice, are you here? Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you about her paper anyway, because it was a very nice poster. Her poster was entitled Environmental Variables as Predictors for Ectomycorrhizal Species in American Chestnut in Mine Reclamation. Mine reclamation sites are considered ideal for chestnut reestablishment because they have low pH, full sunlight, and relatively little competition. Janice's poster compared the ectomycorrhizal communities that colonized both pure American chestnut and hybrids that were bred for blight resistance. She found that the mycorrhizal communities did not at all differ between the hybrids and the pure American chestnuts, and that those that were colonized by ectomycorrhizae indeed grew a lot better. The important thing about that is it means that there were sufficient spores to establish on the tree seedlings in even this mine reclamation site, so that it is possible to reestablish and perhaps regenerate chestnuts in these sites. The judges all noted that she was able to thoroughly explain her methods and significance of her results for restoration, and one reviewer noted that her answers were brilliant, her manner engaging, and her passion infectious. I'm not doing well today. So we can give her applause even though she's not here. The next award is the Cooper Award in honor of one of the founders of modern plant ecology. The Cooper Award is in recognition of an outstanding contribution in geobotany, physiographic ecology, plant succession, or the distribution of organisms along environmental gradients. The winner this year goes to Jacqueline Gill, Steve Jackson, Catherine Lininger, and Guy Robinson for their paper, published in Science in 2009, Pleistocene Megafaunal Collapse Preceded Novel Plant Communities and Enhanced Fire Regimes. The profound environmental and ecological changes accompanying the last deglaciation have provided ecologists with a critical case study for understanding the sensitivity of ecological systems to climate change. As recently as 10,000 years ago, large areas in North America were covered with what is termed no-analog communities, that is, combinations of tree species that we see only rarely today. Prior work on these no-analog communities in the past emphasized climate change as the driver in the past, or suggested that perhaps vegetation patterns were a result of megafaunal herbivory from the now extinct megafauna. What this new paper by Gill and her colleagues creatively uses an approach with spores from a fungus called Sporomyela that is obligate to animal dung. And what they could do is, by looking at those records, they could determined that the no analog plant communities arose only after the megafaunal collapse happened. So that, and that also coincided with a shift to a strengthened fire regime. Gill and her colleagues hypothesized that the Pleistocene megaherbivores helped suppress more palatable hardwoods, so their decline allowed those taxa to increase, which in turn increased loads for fuel. The work by Gill and her colleagues likely will spur further research into the interlinkages among megafauna extinction, vegetation turnover, and fire, which ultimately may resolve longstanding debates about the joint effects of climate change and human arrival in the North American ecosystems. So please help me congratulate Gill and her colleagues for an outstanding paper. And they were escorted by Louis Iverson, a member of the Cooper Award Committee. Next award is the Mercer Award. The George Mercer Award is the oldest of the awards granted by ESA. It is given in memory of a young British ecologist who was killed in action in World War I. The award is given to an author under 40 years of age, that's what it says in the rules, in recognition of a single outstanding paper in ecology published during the last 2 years. This year's Mercer Award goes to Megan Duffy and Spencer Hall, for their paper, Selective Predation and Rapid Evolution Can Jointly Dampen Effects of Parasites on Daphnia Populations, published in the American Naturalist. In this paper, Duffy and Hall elegantly couple observations on the natural population dynamics of a Daphnia host parasite system with mathematical modeling to show that rapid evolution and selective fish predation can explain why two parasites have very different effects on their host. Many parasites are known to be highly virulent, and theory shows that such parasites should strongly regulate their host populations. However, such regulation is uncommonly observed in nature. So to look at this, Duffy and Hall took a comparative approach, contrasting the effects of a bacterial and a fungal pathogen, parasite. Empirical work showed that both parasites were highly virulent to individuals, but only outbreaks of the bacterium influenced Daphna population dynamics in natural lakes. So they then used models parameterized with field data to explore why the virulent fungus had very little influence on Daphnia populations, and the results showed that it was the combined effects of selective fish predation on infected hosts relative to non-infected hosts, as well as very rapid evolution of virulence, both of which they documented, that actually prevented the parasite from infecting host population dynamics. This paper is a model for the tremendous insights that can be gained by combining field parameterized mathematical models with very careful empirical work. The author's study not only provides a resolution to the paradox of virulent parasites with little impact on population dynamics, but communicates two very broad and fundamental messages for ecology. First, that evolution occurring on ecological timescales can alter the course of species interactions. And second, that embedding parasites within food webs is absolutely essential to understanding those food web dynamics. Please join me in congratulating Dr. Duffy and Hall on receiving this year's Mercer Award. And thanks to Priyanga Marasekhari for escorting them from the committee. The next award is the Eugene P. Odom Award for Excellence in Ecology Education. This award recognizes an ecologist for outstanding teaching, research, and mentoring activities and for demonstrated ability in relating basic ecological principles to human affairs. This year's award goes to Professor Kenneth Klimau, Professor of Biology at Wilkes-Barre University. The award recognizes his outstanding work teaching biology and ecology in the classroom and field and as a mentor, for his central role in developing education as an important priority for the work of ESA, and also a third important thing for his ecology education outreach and advice to communities throughout the state of Pennsylvania. Dr. Klimau received his PhD from Syracuse in 1982 and began his career that year at Wilkes University. He's mentored hundreds of undergraduates into appreciating ecology, starting with their very first introductory biology course. He has directed over 60 students in a variety of topics pertaining to wetland ecology, mapping vegetation of mine sites, assessment and remediation of sites, plant community ecology, biology education, and medicinal impacts of plants. His work on real-world problems, especially on mitigation of acid mine drainage and land reclamation, has not only inspired his students, but had a positive impact in the ways that the local and regional governments manage resources. He also plays a critical role in communication in his community of Wilkes-Barre, in organizing displays at Earth Day events, for example, involving Wilkes students and many other events in the community, and connecting them, these undergraduate students, to K-12 education as well. On the national stage, Dr. Klimau played a key role in organizing the education section of the ESA and served as its first chair from 1987 to 1989. He has been chair of the steering committee of the ESA Digital Library of Ecological Teaching Materials that Mary mentioned earlier, and he's been closely involved with the Bioscience Educational Digital Library for AAAS. In short, he has made outstanding contributions in ecology education, both nationally and locally, and we're delighted to award him the Eugene P. Odom Excellence in Education Award. Thank you. Oops, I'm not doing this slowly. Okay, next is the Sustainability Science Award. This is for recognition of the authors of a scholarly contribution that makes the greatest contribution to the emerging science of ecosystem and regional sustainability through the integration of ecological and social sciences. It goes to, this year, it goes to a paper by Martin Lindegren, Molman, Nielsen, and Stenseth, Preventing the Collapse of the Baltic Cod Stock Through an Ecosystem-Based Management Approach, published in PNAS just last year. This paper reports on a study to model the collapse of an economically important fishery. The authors develop a model for ecosystem-based fisheries management based on fishing pressure, salinity, climate, and food web dynamics, and then apply the model to reconstruct the history of the stock. They then use the model to ask whether the collapse could have been prevented under different management scenarios, and demonstrate that in hindsight, that the only way that could have been prevented, avoided, is by adaptive management of fish resources based on environmental conditions. The study is an excellent illustration of the type of work needed to move sustainability science from a discipline that identifies problems to a discipline that develops solutions. The study is a concrete and unequivocal demonstration of adaptive management. While there have been many papers that have highlighted, fewer actually test whether it actually develops an improved outcome, and this paper does. Please join me in congratulating Dr. Lindemann and the Lindegren. I'm honoring you with our founder of ecosystem science here. For his wonderful paper. Congratulations. Okay. The next award is the Robert MacArthur Award. This is given every 2 years to an established ecologist in mid-career for meritorious contributions to ecology and the expectation of continued outstanding research. This year, we're delighted to present the award to Dr. Stephen Pakala of Princeton University. Steve is one of the leading ecologists of his generation. He is a superb scientist whose contributions range from sophisticated mathematics and computation to empirical work, from evolutionary biology to ecology, from plants to animals, from parasite-host interactions to biogeochemical cycles. Steve's research is broadly based, innovative, and well-conceived. He blends theory and application, mathematics and biology, computation and contemplation deftly and with clear goals. His first major contribution in neighborhood models of plant competition has become one of the most influential bodies of research in plant community literature. He has expanded those ideas to his present work on linking population processes and ecosystem dynamics with a focus on global change. In joint work, he has developed a forest growth simulator that is a major advance over competing versions and is investigating its consequences within a spatial context. His development, largely with Ben Boker, of the moment closure method for stochastic miles has generated a huge industry of further development of that theory. He has also been a leader in relating ecological studies to global climate models, addressing critical problems of importance to the future of humanity. He has demonstrated through simulation the importance of biodiversity to predicting the responses of ecosystems to increase carbon, as has extended the community-level investigations to work with Jorge Sarmiento on the carbon cycle. In the last few years, he has thrown himself into these issues with even greater fervor, leading an effort with Robert Sokolow to examine the potential of carbon sequestration, and more generally, to develop a sustainable energy policy. The Bacalo-Sokolow paper on energy wedges is one of the most important papers in environmental science in a decade, and has already had great effect on efforts to address fundamental issues of climate change. He's been a contributor in many other ways, leading centers at Princeton, committed to building bridges between academia, industry, NGOs, and government. He is one of the most important basic ecologists and one of the most important applied ecologists that we have today. No one blends these two components better than he does. Steve Bacalo will present a lecture, the MacArthur Award Lecture, in the plenary section in next year's meeting, but please join me in congratulating him now. He's escorted by Ellen Hastings. The Distinguished Service Citation. This is given in recognition of long and distinguished service to ESA, to the larger scientific community, and to the larger purpose of ecology and the public welfare. The award this time is being given to Rosina Bierbaum of the University of Michigan for her enormous contributions to that last criteria, the application of ecology in the public welfare. Since the beginning of her career, Dr. Bierbaum has worked in the public arena on issues involving the application of ecology to significant societal problems. Her service has included stints in the Congressional Office for Technology Assessment and in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. That included being director of the Environmental Division at OSTP from 1998 to 2001, where she acted as the Clinton administration's senior scientific advisor on environmental research and development. A list of specific contributions to development of environmental policy and serving as a scientific expert to policymakers is enormous. I can only highlight a few of them. She's been closely involved in the IPCC assessment reports and has led the U.S. delegation to the IPCC plenaries for several times. In 2007, she was co-author of the report, Confronting Climate Change, Avoiding the Unmanageable and Managing the Unavoidable. In 2008-09, she was a co-director of the World Bank's annual report on an important policy issue. She developed the report on the intersection of climate change and economic development. This report was released last year and signals a strong shift in the way the World Bank is thinking about carbon dioxide targets and the recognition of the incompatibility of development and unabated climate change. Most recently, she was appointed by President Obama to the President's Council of Advisors and Technology. In all of these roles, she has been an effective advocate for the application of sound ecological science to a wide range of problems. And she has been such an advocate in the halls of power where critical decisions are actually made. In the words of Vice President Al Gore, who wrote a supporting letter for Rosina, she possesses that rare ability to communicate on many levels, policymakers, scientists, lay people, to make the very complex science of climate change accessible and understandable. Her astute assessments of the challenges we face in addressing climate change have been invaluable, and I might add, are going to continue to be so. Please join me in congratulating Rosina. She's escorted by Bob Hope. And the last award that we will present today is the Eminent Ecologist Award for recognition of an outstanding body of ecological work or of sustained ecological contributions of extraordinary merit. The Eminent Ecologist Award goes to, this year, goes to Simon Levin of Princeton University. This is a somewhat older picture, but it's the one he sent us.
It looks the same.
It looks the same. This is to say that he has done, this is the one, the picture that proves that Simon Levin has done field work. He has made many distinguished and durable contributions to the science and practice of ecology over his illustrious career. He has published over 400 papers, many highly cited.
1973?
1973. And authored a number of books. I'm only going to sketch a few of his contributions today. His early papers from the 70s on species coexistence, genetic feedbacks, and patch dynamics in the intertidal, including at Tatoosh here, include many classic examples of elegant ecological theory addressing fundamental questions. Presaging, for example, more recent and indeed current work on how food web interactions influence the maintenance of biodiversity, how evolution in real time modulates population dynamics, and how transient and non-equilibrial dynamics can alter our understanding of ecological systems. Some of his most important and far-reaching contributions have been via his development of the spatial dimensions of ecology. His 1974 paper in the American Naturalist on dispersion and population dynamics, and followed by his 1976 annual review on population dynamics in heterogeneous environments, and his 1977 theoretical population biology article with Robert Whitaker on mosaic phenomena in ecology. All of these illustrate a continuing theme that goes up to today, including his very widely cited paper on pattern and scale in ecology, published in Ecology. His efforts have helped catalyze interest in how spatial processes can alter the outcome of competition between species, as well as many other ecological processes. Working with outstanding mathematicians and a wide range of biologists, Simon Levin has developed fundamental theory on issues such as scaling from individuals to populations, stochastic aspects of spatial ecology, and the ecology and evolution of dispersal. More broadly, he has been an articulate champion for a wide range of research at the interface of mathematics and ecology. He has also articulated a vision of ecological systems as complex adaptive systems, in effect extending his earlier work on coevolution and genetic feedbacks to encompass many aspects of ecosystem resilience. He's not only made many contributions to theoretical ecology, but also to the application of theory to critical society problems with influential publications on ecotoxicology, infectious disease ecology, resource harvesting and management, environmental impact assessment, the release of genetically engineered organisms, and the sustainability of coupled ecological genomic systems. It is difficult to think of any other scientist who has made such a mark across such a wide swath of our disciplines. Besides his many research contributions, Simon has been a superb mentor to many students and postdocs and has faithfully served the Ecological Society of America and more broadly the discipline of ecology in many ways, including, for example, founding the Journal Evolutionary Applications and serving as a president of the Ecological Society of America. He has been the worthy recipient of many other awards, including the just-announced Ramon Margalef Award Prize in Ecology. So please join me in congratulating Dr. Levin. He is escorted to the podium by Bob Holt. So my last comments here are, please participate. We're still doing pictures, okay? Please participate in the nomination process. These awards should come from the society. We want to hear from you. There will be an announcement, opening of nominations will be announced in the bulletin in October, and there will also be an email that goes out to the entire membership urging people to nominate your colleagues, people you know, people whose work you admire for these awards. It's incredibly important that we get nominations, especially of a wide diversity. And finally, I want to thank the subcommittee chairs again, and here are their names. So please, let's congratulate all the award winners again and go on with the plenary.
Deborah, thank you for actually a very animated and informative explanation of the awards and the amazing people who got them. It was great. And it's now my pleasure to introduce this year's scientific plenary speaker. Steve is a researcher who's addressed the complexities of global warming with a keen insight. Stephen W. Running. He's earned his bachelor's and his master's degree from Oregon State University and his doctorate in forest ecology from Colorado State. He's been on the faculty of the University of Montana since 1979. Running's research includes forest stress, terrestrial carbon, water cycles, satellite monitoring of global ecosystem health, which he's done for some 40 years, and he's served in more than 30 national and international committees. Most notably, he was the lead author on a chapter in the International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the fourth assessment. Running's report, which analyzed North America's contribution to atmospheric carbon dioxide and its impacts on the global climate, aided former Vice President Al Gore as he compiled the evidence for his 2006 documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. In 2007, Gore and the IPCC committee, including Running, were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts in disseminating knowledge on climate change. Running currently develops computer models of global and regional ecosystems to study the Earth's changing climate. He's a team member of the NASA Earth Observing System, and he is still an active member of the IPCC. We're very pleased he could join us, and we look forward to his talk entitled Innocence Lost: Will Ecologists Become the Future Global Carbon Cops? Please join me in welcoming Steve Running.
All right. So first, let me find... Okay, that looks like something I recognize. That's more promising. We have hidden icons. There, now we're getting somewhere. So I was out with what I would maybe call some rather unsavory characters last night, and there's this Belgian beer called Delirium Tremens. And you wonder if somebody in Madison Avenue would have ever been smart enough to label a beer that. It's been called that for centuries. And I thought, well, should I have myself a glass of Delirium Tremens before I speak or after? So I decided to wait till after, and let's hope you'll be able to tell the difference here. Innocence Lost. Let me start with this graph. Every one of us knows it. It's the most iconic earth science data set of the century. And would you believe Dave Keeling had trouble keeping his work funded? Just like the rest of us, he struggled to keep grant money to keep the Mauna Loa record going. But read this. Dave wrote in 1968, "The rise in CO2 is proceeding so slowly that most of us today will very likely live out our lives without perceiving that a problem may exist." Talk about innocence. He wrote that in 1968, which is when I was an undergraduate. And so here the most eminent carbon cycle scientists of the century felt that this was an issue that was going to proceed slowly enough that throughout our lifetimes we wouldn't really get concerned. And now fast forward to where we are right now. 40 years later, 50 years later, 40 years from 1968 about, and basically every newspaper you pick up, every weekly magazine you read has something about climate and energy. And we've had a pretty tough year politically this last year in this topic. And yet I think from the broader sweep of where we were 40 years ago, maybe we aren't doing so badly. I think we, as earth scientists, do have the politicians' attention on this issue, the public's attention on this issue, and I don't think we're nearly as innocent as Dave was when he wrote this in 1968. And so my challenge today is to see if I can take you through some of this, not only policy, but carbon cycle science, and help think through what a body like ESA should be trying to contribute in the future. Let's start with carbon emissions. And this is a well-known, well-seen graph of fossil fuel emissions from 1990 to the present. And what I find interesting about this is, is this going to work? No, I thought somebody had this working. What am I doing wrong? Oh, well, and push there. Oh, I'm barely getting it. It's probably dying on me. All right, we got to get back on track here. If you look at the last decade of fossil fuel emissions from 2000 to the present, what you see is, despite all the Kyoto Protocol negotiations and policy, we basically followed the fossil fuel intensive scenario of the IPCC model runs, the A1FI, if you notice from the graphic there. And so we really, in terms of actual performance of humanity in carbon emissions, we didn't really have a very good decade. And we did have a real good year, and that was last year, when you see for the first time it looks like carbon emissions went down. And of course, all it took for that to happen was a global economic near collapse. And so at the moment, that seems to be the only effective way of reducing carbon emissions, is have the economy collapse. And I hope we can collectively find some other alternatives besides that. Now, I'm pleased to say that you won't have to remember all those codes about A2 and B1 and A1FI for the fifth IPCC assessment, because they're changing the scenarios and they're changing the labeling so they make sense to normal humans. And so this is, for the fifth assessment, what the labeling will be for the climate model simulations that are being done right as we speak around the world. They're defined by four radiative forcings from 8.5 watts per meter squared to 2.6, if you can see on the graph. And they're labeled simply with the effective CO2 equivalent that's expected by the end of the century. So from 1370 for the... in effect, the fossil fuel intensive scenario similar to the fourth assessment, down to 490, which is basically where we are right now, of both CO2 and fossil fuel, and CO2 equivalent of other gases. And so as we look forward to the fifth assessment, I think it'll be way easier to understand the model runs. And basically, it's all about this. This graph shows the Earth temperature anomaly over the last 1,000 years. And you'll notice that the natural variability of the system became substantially smaller in about the year 1600. How come? Did the Earth somehow stabilize? No, mercury thermometers were invented then. So the precision of measurement improved. And I think that's something that we want to look forward now for the future. How can we improve the precision of measurement of the carbon cycle? Because I think we're going to be challenged to provide the same sort of information. Now, if you saw the Inconvenient Truth, this is the graph where Al Gore shot up on the stage on a forklift to take you to the top of the graph. And, of course, the top of this graph is a global air temperature increase of 6 degrees by the end of the century. And that effectively is the current temperature projection that the models predict if we continue the emission scenarios that we're on right now. So I showed you what we've done in the last decade in the previous graph. And if we continue that for the rest of the century, that's really where the GCMs expect us to be temperature-wise, is a 6-degree increase. And, of course, I think all of us here understand that we just can't let that happen. Now, let's start getting closer to carbon, since my job is carbon this morning. And this is the track of carbon emissions since 1960. And, of course, fossil fuel has been going steadily up to about 8.7 petagrams last year. Notice, though, that there's a significant track of land use change, deforestation, and fire emissions on the order of 1.2 petagrams per year. This is actually what RED is all about. When you read about in the protocols about RED, it's reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. And you see that it's a significant number. And so as we unpack the carbon balance a little farther, we find that we have these two emission sources, fossil fuel emissions and this variety of land use changes. And it turns out that what we measure in the atmosphere of increasing CO2, the Mauna Loa curve, is only about half of the emissions that are being put out every year. The other half, actually 54% in this estimate, are absorbed by the land sinks and the ocean sinks. And so when we talk about carbon management of the future, we actually have two opportunities. One is on the left-hand side to reduce emissions from deforestation. The other is on the carbon sink side to enhance sink strength of oceans and land ecosystems. So as ecologists, apart from the fossil fuel reduction, we also have these opportunities in these components of the carbon cycle to make some real progress. What we think has happened over the last about 40 or 50 years is that the land fraction of these carbon sinks has stayed more or less stable. And you see a lot of year-to-year variability, but more or less stable. Whereas the ocean fraction has gone down. And it's kind of an interesting game with my ocean friends. We always, after a couple of delirium tremens, you start arguing, my sink's bigger than your sink. And so far, I'm winning. And in fact, there was a paper just this last week on reduction in ocean primary productivity that I think came out in Nature that I hope I have time to read today after this talk, because it might be give us some explanation for this ocean trend that we see here. What I worry more about, though, as I think about the carbon cycle of the planet, is that we have two new ecosystem carbon products that we're going to have to manage for. And one is carbon credits, which are best quantified by what we call net ecosystem exchange. And then the other is biofuels, which are best quantified probably by net primary production. So here we have two carbon variables of huge policy significance. There may be trillions of dollars pointing at those two variables in the coming decades. And we as scientists think of them simply as NEE and NPP. We have to really get up to our A game quick here about how well we can understand and quantify these two components of the carbon cycle, because they're going to get a huge amount of attention. It's only starting now. And so here, for example, with biofuels, you read papers written by economists that will track, here's a biofuel, bioenergy potential from 1990 to 2100, and appropriately colored green stripe is what they see as bioenergy potential. And it ends the century at something like 425 exajoules, probably a unit that you don't normally work with. I don't either. We're finishing a paper right now where we're trying to estimate, well, what's actually the biospheric capacity for biofuel? And without going into a lot of details, we started with the measured global primary production. I mean, all of it. Every chloroplast. And then we basically took out the parts of the carbon system that we don't think we're actually ever going to use for biofuel, such as food you eat and minor details like that. Well, we come up with a bioenergy potential more on the order of 25 to 100 exajoules, something close to an order of magnitude lower than the bioenergy projections the economists are making. These are the sort of things that I think we as ecologists have to step up to the policy table and start putting some real numbers on some of these entities that don't seem to be being recognized adequately enough at this time. Carbon credits, I could go on and on about carbon credits, and I won't in 1 hour. And I decided to just summarize what I worry about with carbon credits with this one model simulation that we did a number of years ago. We had this hypothetical forest that we were simulating, and we just played some games about, over the course of a century, what would be the carbon source and sink strength of this forest. And so above the line is a sink, and below the line is a carbon source. And you can look at 100 years of year-to-year climate variability, and you can see that some years this forest was a carbon sink, but other years that same forest was a source, and purely as a function of interannual climate variability. You add a CO2 signal to that, and it helps a little bit. There is a CO2 fertilization effect, but the big issue was disturbance. When you, in this case, we simulated a big clear cut, you put a pulse of carbon into the atmosphere that it took this forest in this particular simulation about 30 years to reach a carbon neutral point, and then as it continued to regrow, become a carbon sink again. And so from a policy point of view, if you're going to define a carbon credit from this piece of land, exactly what number are you going to use? And how stable do you actually think that number you use might be? And I really think that we don't have appropriate policy language yet in the language I read that represents correctly this kind of variability of carbon sinks that would be translated into carbon credits. And so I start thinking of the sort of things that we as global scale ecologists ought to be thinking about, and one of the things I've put together is an idea like this for a terrestrial carbon monitor at the global scale. And I've tried to identify what I think we can measure with good precision right now. And so I want to take you through in just a few minutes some of these measures and talk about not only how we measure them, but why I think they're the measurements that we think we can offer to the policy community that we have confidence at this point. And an important thing to recognize here is what's not on this. There are a lot of things we wish we could monitor that we just can't at a global scale. And I think it's important that we're honest about what we can't measure. And so as I go through this, pay attention to some of your favorite wish list variables and recognize that they're not here. And there may be a reason for that, and it might be my ignorance, and if so, tell me at the end of my talk. Or it might be we really can't measure these other variables adequately yet to the kind of precision needed. And so we'll talk about measuring land cover globally and change in that land cover. Simple measurement of growing season length, incredibly powerful. It seems almost trivial at a local scale. When you think globally, just quantifying the growing season for the whole world is not a bad step. And then measures like primary production. And then the ground data that we use to test and validate these global estimates. So I better get going here. And being a veteran of ESA, I think my first ESA was 1971, if I remember right. And at that point, I was a field ecologist. Some people that have read only my recent papers don't understand that my first decade of work was as a field ecologist measuring gas exchange of little twigs to try to understand their water stress response. And so I understand as I've gone through my career, upscaling, as you'll soon see, from these twigs to the global scale, I fully recognize that where we initially built our understanding of the systems really was back down at very small scale, hands-on measurement. And I think this is, of course, where ESA has its historical strength. And so we need both as we go up and down this kind of a scaling ladder. And so, yeah, to prove that I once was in the field, I'm taking my master's thesis data there now. And I think my sample size was the twigs off of 10 trees, about the size of your finger. And so I had a lot of scaling ahead of me. I didn't know it at the time. This was when the first ecosystem models were starting to be written in the early 70s. And somebody like Cy Levin was right in the middle of these earliest thinking of how do we take the complexity of an ecosystem and build a computer model that we can then have some fun with. And so in my case, I was doing a tree water balance model. I remember the first time I programmed it, I put the flow function in backwards, and it was sucking water out of the air and pumping it into the soil. And I thought, geez, I had to patent this. I could get rich. Now, as I went through those early years of looking at environmental control of stomatal dynamics, one of the things, as I started to imagine, well, how am I going to think about this for the whole world, is I recognized we really have some pretty fundamental environmental constraints on our, particularly our canopy gas exchange processes, but even beyond that. And they go something like this. I mean, these are so bone simple you learned them in junior high school. You don't get photosynthesis when it's dark outside. And so something as routine as day length turns out to be a very important environmental driver, and we can compute day length for any day of the year, for any point on the Earth's surface, for any slope and aspect in elevation, from first principles of solar geometry. Boy, that's not a bad first start in defining growing season, is just knowing the day length any place you are on the planet. And so in this evaluation of growing season constraints, which took 20 years to do, and you're getting the fast summary, the first constraint was simply day length. And so when we evaluate different climates, in this case, look at the boreal forest in Russia, the edges of this constraint are in the wintertime, it's just plain dark out. And so I know what the photosynthesis will be right away. A second really fundamental constraint, freezing temperatures. Whenever it's below about -2, not very much of our ecosystem is doing very much. And so when you start looking for global generalities, here again is a simple constraint that we can evaluate very easily from climate data. And so as we're analyzing this boreal forest, we say, well, in the wintertime it's real dark, and then as the day length starts to come back, it's still real cold. So we have two constraints holding this ecosystem back in the boreal forest. Our final, very fundamental constraint, water availability. And so if we can evaluate by some simple metric when water is available and when it isn't, then we again have a way of just simply evaluating growing season dynamics before we get into the hard stuff, the plant physiology, all the different species interaction. That's the hard stuff to me. I like to stick with these biophysical principles that are straightforward and easy. And so when we put together simple constraints like that, we can go anywhere on the planet and get a first approximation of that ecosystem's dynamic. So what I've done in this slide is compare a boreal forest in Russia with light constraints, temperature constraints, and then finally really not much water constraint there, with an African savanna, which has no temperature constraints ever. It has a little bit of a day length constraint in the midwinter, but basically in the African savanna, the game's all about water. Imagine going anywhere on the planet and going through this same simple thought process. We can do that. We have done that. And you end up with a growing season definition for the everywhere on Earth that mixes these three primary controls in what we think is an ecologically realistic way. And so this is the way you start scaling your plot level ecology to the globe, is starting with the simplest principles first, not the hardest ones. And so we've done this in a number of ways. This is a better artistic rendition of effectively the same type of logic of evaluating the multiple constraints of light, temperature, and water on ecosystems on a global basis from these really simple principles. Now, this was the cover of Science that I guess changed my career trajectory. This is when Compton Tucker, down there in the right, lower right, first came up with the NDVI, the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index data sets for the world. And this started in the early 1980s and, of course, has continued to this day. But this was the first time we had ever actually seen a whole continent or the whole world. You looked at Rand McNally atlases as a kid that showed these colored maps, but we as a humanity had never actually been high enough up to look down at the planet. And these data sets finally gave us the ability to do that. So I suppose we all have one eureka moment in our career, and to me, this was the one. I was in Australia on sabbatical, and I did a first graphic in a simple Quattro Pro spreadsheet comparing this NDVI data set that Compton Tucker had sent me with our model estimates of daily photosynthesis and transpiration. And when this graph popped up, my jaw just dropped, because I instantly knew that NDVI told us something about ecosystems that was worth following up on. The way this simply followed the basic growing season trajectory of this, in this case, this I was using Madison, Wisconsin. The way this represented that those ecosystem seasonality just straight out of the box from this NDVI data set, I knew was worth pursuing. And so now, 30 years later, how do we do this? Well, nowadays what we do is we use a couple of simple algorithms to calculate global primary productivity. I won't go into details of these, but basically you're quantifying the absorption of PAR radiation, and then you have this tremendously magic little what I call the conceptual garbage can of the epsilon conversion efficiency. Basically, all of your carbon cycle ecology is all inside epsilon. And so you're calculating every day the absorption of radiation and its conversion to tissue growth. Boom. Simple as that. And so the good thing is you can do this for 110 million square kilometers every day. You can then add some basic respiration calculations, and you can end up at the end of the year with a net primary production calculation for every square kilometer of the Earth's surface. Now, you have some biome-specific physiology embedded in the algorithm, so it isn't quite as naked as it looks, but it's still pretty simple compared to a full-up carbon cycle model. And yet, we can do a global evaluation of NPP every year. So this was using this algorithm. This is a paper we had in Science in 03, looking at the satellite record from 1982 to 1999, where we found that overall primary production had increased globally over that period. We can continue this kind of calculation and do so right to this day with the NASA Earth Observing System. We calculate this algorithm every day, and it's put out every year, primary production of the Earth. We can make all sorts of pictures like this. We can look every year and see interannual variability of the dynamics of primary production. You see at a glance regions that had a good year and had a bad year, and this is something that you can then do globally. And you can zoom in to a local area. So this is my backyard, and what I find interesting is this actually shows rain shadow effects. It shows elevational effects of primary prediction, production going up the mountainsides. And this is simply based on this satellite record and these little algorithms. So this gets to be pretty realistic of topographic patterns of productivity, even from these simple algorithms. And The other part that the carbon cycle scientists like is this turns out to be highly correlated with the interannual variability of atmospheric CO2. And so this, in effect, this is helping explain the Mauna Loa CO2 curve, that seasonality that you see in the Mauna Loa curve, and the interannual variability. And so we have a paper in Press with Science that'll be out in a couple of months that is the last 10 years of primary production trends with the new satellite. And I guess to give you the punchline without any details, we no longer see the overall biospheric productivity is increasing with global warming. It appears to be at a point that this last decade it decreased. And in effect, it's what it boils down to is the enhancement of growing season by warmer temperatures is now becoming progressively overcome by drought effects and water stress. And so back to this basic tension between our fundamental environmental variables. Now, we can spend a lot of time going through testing these algorithms. I'm not going to crawl through a lot of details here with you. We have to evaluate how good the component meteorology is, the algorithms for the satellite, all that kind of stuff. Turns out that when you work with a satellite, the first thing you worry about is cloud cover. Look at how much cloud cover you get in the Amazon. Over 70% of the days at the satellite overpass time, you don't see a thing. Well, I guess if you're a cloud scientist, you see lots. So I have to watch out what I say here. But for us ecologists, we don't see a thing 70% of the time or worse. Also in the high latitudes, you see a huge fraction of the days you lose in cloud cover. So there's ways that we have to fix that. That involves screening out clouds. Now, probably the most important reason that I can stand here and show you a global NPP map and have some confidence that it isn't just a joke is because of the Flux Tower network worldwide. And these eddy covariance flux towers, they were first developed in the early 90s, they started getting going. And by about the mid-1990s, some of these flux towers started to start continuous measurements. Well, that's right when I was writing these algorithms for the EOS satellite. And so I saw immediately that these flux towers would be a point where I could come down and I could validate our algorithm for wherever there was a flux tower. And so we developed a pretty carefully thought through strategy of how a flux tower represents a point on a heterogeneous landscape, like the upper image shows, and then how we can take components of these calculations in and out. Instead of using the global meteorology, I can take the meteorology right from the flux tower. So I know that I've got that part exactly right, and then I can run the satellite algorithm. So I can disassemble where my sources of error are between meteorology, between the satellite radiometry, between the ecosystem theory, between the land cover measurements, all those things I can partition out my error. And this is the sort of level of, I think, detail and understanding we have to get these carbon measurements to. And so to just give you one example, you'd think I liked Wisconsin. It's got such a nice, stable seasonality that I don't want to live there or anything. It rains too much. But I do find that I love to use their seasonalities because it's just textbook. And so here is a graph of the daily gross primary production as measured by the flux tower compared toe-to-toe against the daily GPP calculated by our satellite algorithm. And imagine doing this for every flux tower worldwide, of which there's about 400 of them at the moment in a well-organized network. The Harvard Forest Tower is the longest-running tower in the world at this point, started in 1992 and still going. But imagine this as a set of, in effect, ground control points for this satellite-based data set going on over top of it, so to speak, worldwide. And so that was the concept I had in the early 90s, and I think it's working now because I can go to any one of these flux towers anywhere on the in the world, and I can see how good my satellite algorithm worked for that exact square kilometer any day of the year. And so this is a connection between top-down and bottom-up science that I think has turned out to be just fantastic. One of the things you might have spotted that the satellites do well is phenology. I've always been kind of a nut for phenology because it's the most immediate vegetation response to climate variability we have, and especially looking at things like springtime bud burst. And so here you can imagine looking at bud burst from a satellite vegetation index record. And of course nowadays we have the National Phenology Network, which I don't have anything directly to do with, but I'm absolutely thrilled it exists and that an agency actually stepped up to sponsor it. When's the last time one of our agencies volunteered to sponsor new science? It was really unheard of. And so the National Phenology Network gives us, again, this from our top-down satellite look, we have bottoms-up direct measurements of things like spring bud burst to compare against. We can look at things like hardiness zones, and this is a look at the hardiness maps, the arborists, as they call it, a map back in the 90s versus 2006. And sure enough, the hardiness zones are working their way north, as you might expect with a warming climate. It's important to recognize that as temperatures increase, looking at the average temperature is probably the most boring temperature to look at of all. And it always kills me that this is what the journalists always talk about, the annual average temperature of the world. To a climatologist, that's the least interesting number they could possibly choose. And so what we like to look at are things like the distribution of temperatures. And so this is an expectation of where the distribution of temperatures might go. One of the most fun things we've had with our satellites is to look at where's the hottest place on Earth. And this is not serious research at all, but it's sure been great fun because it starts really cool arguments after delirium tremens time. Have you ever been to the hottest place on Earth? Yeah, well, where is it? Well, and how hot was it? Well, now you know. There it is. The satellite measures every square kilometer every day, and you see that unfortunately this punishing desert in Iran just has taken the competition by storm. Australia won once, China won once, and ever since then it's been a landslide. And look at the temperatures, 70 degrees centigrade. Now these aren't air temperatures. These are radiometric surface temperatures. These are the temperatures that when you walk barefoot on dry sand, this is what you're feeling. This is your foot temperature, 70 degrees centigrade. Well, we can monitor this forever now, the high temperatures for any place on Earth. And it's along with being kind of fun and curious like this, it's actually a pretty important climate change metric too. As we look at temperature, we also are trying to look at changes in water balance. But you don't simply look at precipitation. You look at the net between precipitation minus potential evaporation. That's what an ecosystem lives on, is the net, not the gross. What we see for the West, for example, here, is that we really have had an aridification of the West over the last 25 years, with a little spot in Northern California that seems to be doing better in water balance. But we certainly see that aridification is primarily the trend that we'll see. Let me talk a little bit about land cover change in that red policy. This is something satellites can do really well, is change detection of basic land cover, as long as you don't expect them to name every species down there. That's always been the disconnect with the biodiversity crowd is they wanted all the species named. Well, we can't do that, but what we can do is look at every square kilometer on Earth every single year and tell you if it changed in a meaningful way or not. And this is a paper in PNAS just a few months ago on percent forest cover loss over the last 6 years worldwide. And you can, the point is not so much the numbers here, is the fact that this is a monitoring that we can now do very regularly and very accurately. Now, when you talk about land cover change, this is the way we do it in Montana. This is my favorite wildfire picture. This is from the top down, what it looks like from the space shuttle. And it reminds us that for us in the U.S., disturbances, natural disturbances, are a major part of our land cover change every year. And that's something that we can map global fires every week. And so this is something that is really both an important thing to measure for ecological measurements and with high policy relevance in change detection. Large-scale insect epidemics. We're having quite a mountain pine beetle outbreak throughout the West that started up in British Columbia, as you can see from this graph. Well, dead trees are pretty easy to see compared to live trees. And so this is, again, a measure that we think we're at the point that if you look at, this is a new paper on forest mortality worldwide by Allen et al. And we think we're at the point now where we can, with an annual satellite-driven disturbance index, measure worldwide where there's major disturbances. And not only where there's disturbances, but the rate of recovery of those disturbances, which is often forgot about. A tropical forest will typically recover, at least in leaf area, in under 10 years, whereas a boreal forest, it may take 50. And so the recovery rate is not equal worldwide, and that's something we should and can, I think, monitor effectively now. And so I'm starting to imagine that maybe this sort of global monitoring might finally be mature enough to help out in things like quantifying ecosystem services. And so I've started to doodle with these sorts of measures of, well, for carbon services, could we at least talk about areas that are trending up and trending down? I think we can in this relative sense. We won't get the sort of plot level direct numbers that you can on the ground, but we can cover the whole world every year. So how do we generate policy-relevant information from all this? Well, to me, this is maybe for my generation the first example of policy-relevant global ecology. And I still have this book. And probably people with hair color, my color in this room, probably read this all when we were undergraduates, and The Limits to Growth. And, you know, a lot of people argued that it was all wrong and way off base and things like that. And maybe only those my age care whether it was accurate or not. But there was a real cool paper by this Australian Turner just a couple years ago reevaluating those limits to growth simulations. And to get right to the punchline, you go back to those simulations and you look at how many of their measures of human activity peaked right about now. In the early 21st century. And it gives you kind of a pause that even with these simple models of the time, they looked at some of the most fundamental trends of humanity and they found things peaking right about now. They look at, for example, here on food production. And And of course, there were some simulations highly optimistic that showing this tremendous food production potential. Here's what actually has happened in the 40 years since they wrote the book. And you recognize that we haven't started losing in food production capacity, but it isn't going up very fast. And it certainly isn't going up the way some of the optimistic scenarios would have suggested were possible. And so I start thinking, okay, how do we start distilling what we as ecologists know about trends of the biosphere into something that maybe they can register better than just our raw data sets? And so I was part of helping of IGBP defining this climate change index that we inaugurated at the Copenhagen COP meeting last December. And it simply puts together the trend of sea level rise, that global average temperature, the CO2 trend, of course, and Arctic sea ice loss, and puts it all together and normalizes it, gets all the units out of the way. And so it's kind of like a Dow Jones Industrial Index of climate. And the whole point of it is not for the scientist at all. It's for the non-scientist to see the basic trend we see of the Earth system without the details. You know, we sometimes forget. I had a lady in a prominent NGO that I was lecturing to that was really well involved in environmental science came up to me after a talk and said, "Dr. Running, what's PPM? We forget that something as fundamental as parts per million CO2 in the Mauna Loa curve, the public maybe doesn't know what that means. And if they do, it sounds pretty little. So we have a lot of translating to do that I think we too often just think past, because it's so ingrained in us since junior high, we forget that it isn't obvious to everybody else too. I think Mary already showed Rockstrom's planetary boundaries paper, and in effect, this is a new label on the limits to growth. It's basically an updated idea of how can we start quantifying limits to the Earth system, and then how do we label it and deliver it in a way that maybe you'll get some attention. And I thought planetary boundaries is a pretty good label to get attention, because it makes it clear we're talking the whole planet, and boundaries has that ring to it that we hope is meaningful. And it's a very good concept. And I think it's the kind of concept that within the concept we can be defining a lot of different variables as we develop the ability to measure them adequately and add to this concept. And I hope this does get some traction in the policy community. What I worry about is that we let the economic sector continue to run the planet. And I couldn't help but be dumbfounded. Alan Greenspan, when he retired, he considered he could walk on water. And here he was testifying under oath to the House. "I discovered a flaw in the model that I perceived as the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works." Have you ever said that about one of your models? Never. But the point is, we ecologists don't run the global economy. These guys do. They lost $30 trillion and they don't know why and they don't know where it went. I am not impressed by that level of intellectual leadership. I really think that we understand the global climate better than we do the global economy. And what I highly recommend to President Obama is that they put us in charge. Well, not me personally, because I tend to lose my train of thought way too quickly. But all joking aside, We currently have an Earth system run by economists, and I don't think they're up to the task anymore. And we as Earth system scientists really have to get our place at the table and put in the kind of things that we measure and see, and I think we'll do just as good as they do. We might recover from wrecking the global economy. We think it's on the way, but I don't know if we can recover if we wreck the entire biosphere. So I have a daughter who's a PhD student in sociology, and so she's working me to read more of the science from the other side of campus, let's call it. And, of course, one of the things, I was reading a book on the plane coming out yesterday that is about the World Happiness Index that has been going on for a good while, and America doesn't win, I can assure you. But I think a little more tangibly to me, I've found this book particularly interesting about gross domestic product is what currently is the measurement of how well the country's doing. Obama every week talks about his GDP going up or down, and if it's going down, it's bad by definition. And I found this quote of Robert Kennedy's, GDP measures everything except that which makes life worthwhile. I think we do have to find, as ecologists and environmentalists, a way to take society beyond measuring everything in economic value. And I don't know how we're going to do that, but we better get started, because I think these other measures are part and parcel of keeping the biosphere intact, and really our label of sustainability that we've had in ESA for decades doesn't seem to translate very well to the public. And so even though it's scientifically a very accurate thing to talk about, I don't know if that's the best way for us to be trying to argue to the public and the policy makers what we see is needed at a global scale. Because we really do have to sustain the entire biosphere, and yet we've got to find a way that we'll get the interest of those individuals in that biosphere. I find this picture when I give public talks to really grab people. It's the most distant picture of Earth ever taken. So this was a Saturn satellite probe that, as it was orbiting Saturn, they pointed the cameras back and took a picture of Earth from a billion kilometers away. And so one of the things we know quite confidently is for at least a billion kilometers in every direction, this is the only planet that can sustain us. And so we better not screw it up. So, and then, all right, now I have to go out of this to leave you with, oh, man. So much for quick interactions. Yeah, so this is a look at the 6 years of global primary production that we've taken from the satellite, both land and ocean. And so this is the kind of raw measurement of the biosphere we can take, but I know that I can't just send this to the White House and expect them to automatically start changing public policy. So we're getting better at, in effect, the raw material of our carbon cycle science, but I don't think we've turned the corner well enough to how to get it into the public consciousness what we really need humanity to do. Thank you.
planned it that way, yes. And I'm leaving on the next plane, too. No, I'm here all week.
Terrific. So you'll have a chance to talk to him more. And with that, I'll close the session and say that refreshments are served outside. And again, Steve, thank you for just a fantastic talk.